Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science girl, and today we're going to be discussing an issue that has been on the forefront of everybody's minds this summer, Hawaii's coral bleaching event. Like most, if you've been in the ocean this summer, you've noticed that there's a lot of white corals. Here to talk about why this event is taking place and how it is affecting our reefs is Dr. Kuhle Rogers, Chris Jury, and Dr. Courtney Couch. I'm so grateful to have these experts from the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, here in the studio with us today. I have a ton of questions, as I'm sure our audience does as well, so let's get right into it. First, I want to chat with Chris. Chris Jury is a PhD candidate at the University of Hawaii. Chris is completing his work in biological oceanography and examining how corals respond to environmental change from the geologic past to the future. A major focus of his research addresses the potential for corals to adapt to human-induced climate change and ocean acidification, a timely topic for today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly. Glad to be here.
So let's start at the very, very basics here, Chris. What is coral bleaching?
So when most folks look at a coral, probably they see a rock, right? The reef is built out of big rocky structures. So that rock is the skeleton of the coral. A live coral is just a few millimeters on the outside of that rock of live tissue. It's an animal related to sea anemones or jellyfish, things like that, and it actually builds the structure, builds the skeleton that becomes the reef. Corals live symbiotically with a particular type of algae. The algae give them a lot of their color. Brown corals are brown because they have the brown algae. So under certain kinds of stress, particularly high temperature stress, that symbiosis between the coral and the algae starts to break down. The corals lose their symbiotic algae, and you see right through their tissues then, you see the white skeleton underneath. And that's quite problematic for the corals because 80, 90% of their food comes from the symbiotic algae. So without the algae, they're in hot water, excuse the pun.
So our corals are animals, but they also have some rock and plant like attributes as well there.
Exactly. So in the classic switch between plant, animal, or mineral, corals get yes, yes, and yes.
And so when they are bleached, though, that doesn't automatically mean the coral's dead, right?
Correct. So a bleached coral is still alive. It's lost a lot of its symbiotic algae. So it looks white because it doesn't have the color from the symbiotic algae, but it's still alive. Bleached corals, though, are severely stressed. They're basically on a starvation diet. And if they recover, if they can recover before things get too bad, they can ultimately survive that bleaching event. If the stress lasts too long, if they're hit by other stressful events during that same time when they're bleached and weakened, then they'll die.
And so is there a certain time period where if they've been bleached for, let's say, I don't know, a month, then they're likely to die or come back? Is there a certain threshold there?
It varies. It varies depending on the species and how sensitive that particular species is to the bleaching. It varies depending on the intensity of the stress. So more stressful, high temperatures, the higher, the worse. That can impact it. There are other factors that come into it. There isn't an exact threshold, but suffice to say, the longer they're bleached, the more likely they are to die.
Sure. And do we see with certain species, the coral species or the stony species we have here in Hawaii, are they hardier species? Are they more resistant to this bleaching, or are they kind of on their deathbeds right now?
We've got a mixture out there. So there are corals, for example, at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology that I know a month ago were bone white. They looked like a sheet of paper. And they're already starting to get some of their pigment back. So some of those corals, I expect, will ultimately recover and ultimately will survive. I know there are other corals around, both in Kaneohe Bay and some other locations I've been to recently, that are bone white, and some of them are already starting to die. So it varies by species, it varies by location. It varies depending on small scale things, but we've got a mixture out there. Some corals are probably going to survive and recover. Others are already going downhill.
So you did a really good job of explaining basically why the corals bleach, but what is causing this bleaching per se?
So this bleaching event, and we also had bleaching in Hawaii last year, is caused by high seawater temperatures. And ultimately, we're having much higher than normal seawater temperatures in Hawaii because of climate change, because of global warming. So we know the climate is warming up. We know that's happening because of human activities. And as the climate continues to warm from the emissions of greenhouse gases, this sort of bleaching event is going to become more common in Hawaii and other places, get more intense, and potentially kill a lot of those corals that today can still recover.
And how much of that is affected by this El Nino that we're seeing this year? I just spent some time sailing from Marshall Islands to Honolulu, and we were really seeing some of the, classic El Nino symptoms of the ocean that a lot of oceanographers were expecting to see.
Right. So El Nino is a periodic oscillation in the atmospheric and ocean currents across the Pacific Ocean. So normally, under normal conditions, we have upwelling around the equator in the Pacific and in the eastern Pacific, like off of Peru, upwelling of cool water that comes from deep down the ocean. During an El Nino, which pops up every 2 to 7 years on average, it comes and it goes, we have, instead of that cooler water coming up to the surface, the layer of warm water in the Pacific gets thicker, and you have warm water and extra warm water up at the surface. So particularly in places like the Line Islands, 1,000 miles to the south of us near the equator, they're seeing much higher than normal seawater temperatures because of this El Nino. It's causing a lot of problems there. Here in Hawaii, we're far enough north, we're far enough removed that El Nino doesn't have a big impact on our seawater temperatures here, but if it affects weather worldwide.
So are the warming waters here in Hawaii a result of a combination of a little bit of El Nino, a little bit of warming temperatures in the world, and I guess that those would be the two main causes?
El Nino might have a little bit to do with what we're seeing in Hawaii. It definitely is a major factor in some other places that are closer to the equator. There's also this other natural oscillation called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And in the quote-unquote negative phase of that, you typically get higher temperatures in the western Pacific, like Japan and Korea. In the positive phase, you get warmer temperatures in the eastern Pacific and the central Pacific, like California and Hawaii. So those natural influences, maybe a little bit of El Nino, maybe a little bit of the PDO, those probably are influencing the temperatures here a bit, but ultimately it's the fact that the whole Pacific Ocean and the rest of the planet is getting a lot warmer due to climate change that's causing this. So a little bit of natural variation, mostly climate change.
Gotcha. And have we seen bleaching like this before in Hawaii, or is this the first time that we're seeing something like this?
We've had bleaching in Hawaii before, but this, I think, is going to go down in the record books as by far the most extensive, by far the worst. So in 1996, we saw the first real widespread bleaching event. We had bleaching in Kaneohe Bay, a few other places in Hawaii. Last year, we also saw bleaching across the main Hawaiian islands. It was particularly bad on the windward coast of Oahu and off of Kauai. This year, though, when I go to every shore around Oahu, every single place I go, there's bleaching. We've never seen that before.
It's certainly noticeable. You hear even just tourists on the beach in Waikiki even noticing white corals, asking what's going on. So how does this bleaching affect your research that you're doing, and how does it affect it at all?
It's a little good, it's a little bad. So right now we're setting up to conduct some long-term experiments looking at the potential for corals to adapt to these warmer conditions and what's what's called ocean acidification. So by emitting carbon dioxide into the water, not only does it warm up the climate, it also changes the chemistry of the oceans. Ideally, we wanted to get the corals all collected before we had bleaching. We didn't quite get that done, so it's interrupted that work slightly. On the other hand, though, we know that there are variations in the susceptibility of corals to bleaching in nature. So, for example, on some of the reefs near our lab at the Hoy Institute of Marine Biology, on the reef flats a few weeks ago, probably 95% of the corals were bleached pure white. They looked bad, suffice to say. But 5% of them weren't bleached. What's different about those 5%? Could those 5% be the key to reefs in a future warmer world? We're working on answering those questions.
How do you answer those questions? I mean, are you just going out there and doing observations on the reef, or do you take samples, or how does that work?
It all starts with observation, certainly. You've got to notice these patterns in order to start asking the right kinds of questions to address what's going on and what potentially could this mean for the future. So it starts with the observations, but we're combining a suite of techniques, including genetic techniques, a variety of different physiological techniques, some experiments in aquariums at HIMB that allow us to track corals over the long term, over a few years. And it's the combination approach of using very, very high tech techniques along with basic observations that allow us to make important inferences about where our reef's going.
And have you found any trends or patterns so far? How long have you been doing your work for?
Too long. Thank you for that. I've been out in Hawaii a little over 6 years now, working on these sorts of questions. What I'll say is the good news is we are finding that there is this natural variation. Like I mentioned, there are some corals that under stressful conditions bleach and die. Different individuals of those same species under those same stressful conditions not only survive, they grow faster. That could be a key to the future. We're still working on the details, but there's a nugget of hope. However, having said that, survive and continue growing under those stressful conditions, even those ones, those stress-tolerant ones, you can push them too far. If we don't address climate change now, eventually we're going to push them too far and there won't be much left.
So doing the work that you do and seeing these changes, do you find that you're hopeful for figuring out ways to strengthen the reef? Are you worried about the future of the coral reefs here in Hawaii?
I always tell folks I am a cautious optimist. There are a lot of problems facing our reefs. Bleaching is a very serious one, and especially when you look at where we're going. This year is just the tip of the iceberg. In a few decades, this year will be an average year. So some years will be even worse. That's very problematic. We also have impacts from things like sediment running into the ocean. I drove in from Kaneohe this morning. We had heavy rain this morning, and the amount of mud in the water running right into the ocean was just staggering. That kind of stuff stresses out the corals, and particularly when they're bleached, it makes it that much more difficult for them to survive and for the reef to recover. So we've got a lot of problems out there, but I know that these are fixable problems. A lot of places throughout the state, mostly local groups, have been taking action and improving the problems that we're facing. If we can see that on a larger scale, then I've got hope for our reefs.
Well, I certainly commend the work that you're doing, and I hope that the cautious optimist comes out, because I really like that. Are you just working in the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in Kaneohe Bay area, or are you doing observations elsewhere in Oahu and the main Hawaiian Islands?
Our work ranges. So we certainly work in Kaneohe Bay a lot, but a lot of what we're doing right now focuses on all the shores around Oahu. And we're based on Oahu. Oahu is, the very shores are easy to get to by driving. So we have sites on the east shore, on the north shore, the west shore, the south shore, in Kaneohe Bay, kind of all the way around. And that's fantastic because we know there are some natural gradients in temperature and chemistry and wave exposure, things like that. So we can get within our little microcosm of Oahu, we can get an idea of what's likely to be going on more broadly in Hawaii, and ultimately what we might expect not only on Hawaiian coral reefs, but on other coral reefs around the world.
Sure. And as we get into the cooler months now, I think we've sort of peaked on our summer heat and finally getting some relief from those humid days. Do you expect to see the coral start to make a recovery with the temperatures going down a bit?
I do, at least for some of them. Some of them have started to recover as we've gotten to cooler water over the last few weeks. On the flip side, some of them have also started to die. The stress was just too much for them. So time will tell exactly where we end up. I'm cautiously optimistic that we won't see devastation the way some other places have, where you get a bleaching event like this and 90% of the coral is dead 6 months later. I don't think we're going to see that. I hope we don't see that. But there are definitely corals dying out there. And it should give us pause.
Yeah, especially with the fact that corals grow so slowly, I don't think, you know, that's something in the general public's knowledge. Can you comment on that?
Right. Corals, it varies by species, but most of them grow at most an inch, maybe a couple inches a year. So when you get a big bleaching event like this, as we've seen in other places around the world, you can, over the course of a few months, see decades worth of coral die in a few months.
We'll keep that cautious optimism there. Thank you so much, Chris, for sharing your knowledge with us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to chat more about coral bleaching with Dr. Kuhle Rogers.
Good news from Dynavite. New No More Flea flea and tick spray kills fleas and ticks with no poison. New No More Flea is totally safe for dogs, cats, puppies, kittens, kids, babies crawling on the carpet, and even you. Because it's made from vegetable oil. No More Flea dissolves the hard shell of a flea or tick on contact, so the moist insides of that flea or tick just dry up.
No fleas.
No More Flea instantly. No more ticks soon thereafter. Best of all, no more poison ever. So as of today, you can stop using imidacloprid, moxidectin, pyrethrin, and all those other flea and tick poisons. Get all the grisly nitty-gritty about fleas and ticks, or before your beloved pet ventures out in the backyard again, order a 30 or 60-day supply of new No More Flea. Just click the pic of the dead flea on Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
Dynovite.com.
A message from DAV to returning veterans. Thank you for doing your duty and doing our bidding. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way and putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for defending our freedom and displaying your honor. DAV thanks all veterans by fighting to get them the benefits and support they were promised. Visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we are talking about the important topic of coral bleaching. With us now is Dr. Kuhle Rogers. Dr. Rogers has been part of the Coral Reef Ecology Lab at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology since 1993, working on a wide range of ecological projects that focused on global and local impacts to coral reefs. Welcome to the show, Kuhle.
Thanks for having me, Carly.
Now, this isn't your first time here, actually. We've had you on before.
Yes, you have.
So it's been a couple years, though, and we haven't really talked about this bleaching topic in a long time. So I'm very interested in chatting with you about your impressions of what's going on and how long you think this bleaching event is going to last.
Okay, temperatures are cooling, as Chris mentioned, but the corals will begin to recover soon, like he said. But each year, we're going to be losing more and more coral. Climate change is happening at an alarming rate, faster than any other time in the past. Genetic adaptations can't keep up with the rapid pace. The coral thermal thresholds, which is the temperature that they can withstand, have not changed over the past 20 years, but bleaching and mortality have increased. And this means that the corals are not changing rapidly enough to prevent bleaching. What we also need to understand that this isn't a passing event. This will be our new normal. A common misunderstanding is that we can reverse the conditions if we stop adding greenhouse gases. The truth is that even if all carbon emissions were to end today, the oceans would still continue to absorb a significant amount of gases. Although we can slow the increase, carbon levels will not be reduced. This is something that happens on geologic scales, hundreds to thousands of years. Increases will continue to raise the temperature at least to another 2 degrees C, and corals can't tolerate this. I am a realist, although I also am an optimist. But there will be winners and losers in a warmer, more acidic ocean, and corals will be among the losers. We'll be undergoing a major shift from a coral-dominated to an algal-dominated reef as mortality continues with these bleaching events. And another misconception is that only reefs with chronic histories of stressors, like heavy fishing pressure, pollution, sedimentation, nutrification, those undergo bleaching. You'll hear from Dr. Courtney Couch, in a few minutes on details about Papahanaumokuakea, the Marine National Monument, in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, where there are not these type of impacts, but there was devastating bleaching and mortality. So even in the absence of direct human stressors, you are going to find coral bleaching and dying as the oceans become warmer. NOAA has a coral reef watch. It's headed by Dr. Mark Eakin, and it uses satellite data to provide current environmental conditions. And they've been really good about modeling the sea surface temperature, and it's highly accurate. And already coral mortality has been reported worldwide. They're expecting losses of 10 to 20% this year, although here in Hawaii it may not be as high. Warmer waters are expected to hit the Great Barrier Reef this spring. Dr. Camilo Mora at the UH, has predictive models that show by mid-century, 2043, the hottest day today will be the coldest day then.
Wow. Well, that was a lot of information to take in, Kule. I want to go back and talk about the corals for a second here. Now, they're pretty sensitive in terms of the change that they can withstand. What's their threshold? I mean, you know, you're talking about these drastic temperature changes or things that change them. When do they start to turn?
Well, one of the researchers at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, Dr. Paul Joe Keel, in the early 1970s, found that thermal tolerances to corals throughout the world, wherever they are within 1 to 2 degrees centigrade of their maximum summer temperatures. And this has held true today, no matter where you are, whether it's high temperatures in Samoa, if it's 30 degrees C, they'll bleach at 31 or 32. Here, if it's 27, 28, they'll bleach at 29, 30, no matter where you are. So the temperatures, the tolerances of these corals has not changed.
And you mentioned the NOAA modeling and that they're seeing some events. I wonder how that relates to the press release that NOAA sent out earlier this week or last week, talking about this being the third ever global bleaching event. Can you comment on that?
Yes. This is unprecedented. This last year and this year has been unprecedented in the history of the world. The NOAA is a major key player. There's a lot of people right now that are keeping track of this bleaching, and these include government organizations like the Division of Aquatic Resources, Papahanaumokuakea, Marine National Monument, non-governmental organizations such as the Nature Conservancy, and researchers throughout the state. We're all working together in order to look at these problems and to address bleaching. A program that UH researcher Dr. Greta Abbey has is called Eyes of the Reef. And a couple of weeks ago, they conducted what they called a Bleachapalooza, where community members, managers, scientists all got together to look at what the extent of bleaching was and what areas were affected. And just like Chris said, it was pretty much every island. They had over 150 reports of bleaching, and it was mainly shallow water, although deeper waters that also can be affected.
Wow. Well, it's nice to hear that there's some community involvement and concern about these reefs. Now, I know you work on a coral reef monitoring program as well called CRAMP, Coral Reef Assessment and Monitoring Program. Tell me a little bit about the history of that and what you do for your monitoring.
Okay. CRAMP started in 1998 in response to management needs, since there was no statewide long-term monitoring program in the state at that time. And scientists need to know, and managers, what the reefs were doing, how they were changing over time. And now there's the NOAA Coral Reef Ecosystem Division that has a Pacific-wide program that is also wide scale. But with the continued efforts of the Division of Aquatic Resources, Maui, and others, we're getting a very clear picture of what the conditions of reefs are and able to locate and identify impacts at particular sites. Over the last 15 years, we found that the overall coral cover and diversity in Hawaii have remained relatively stable. The greatest number of sites with significant declines has been on the island of Maui, and with the highest proportion of sites with significant increases has been the Big Island, especially on the Kona coast. However, up until these times, these were all due to local impacts like sedimentation, high nutrients, and other chronic disturbances. But now we're going to start seeing some of these declines occurring because of global impacts. During this 15-year period, coral reefs in the Caribbean and other regions declined as much as 50% due to climate change-related bleaching events, and it lowered the coral growth and disease started. But Hawaii has escaped so far these drastic changes. And it's because we occupy a unique geographic position in the area of the central North Pacific that's escaped these major bleaching events and sea level rise. Most of our reefs are located on island slopes near deep oceanic water with waves that flush a lot of this and moderate temperature. And we're also free of industrial development, mining, other highly polluting activities, although we do have sediment problems and feral ungulates. But although half of all the reefs in the wider Pacific region are currently listed as threatened by the World Resources Institute, Hawaii has one of the lowest overall threat ratings. But this reprieve for Hawaii has now ended. The global impacts are now trumping the local impacts. Chris talked about the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and the effect that El Nino has, which is slight, on the temperature increases. But the PDO has come into reversed into this warmer phase. So we're going to be seeing severe widespread bleaching. There's a long-term record at Cocoa Head on temperature, and it has continued to increase, and it will continue, and we will not be able to ameliorate this anymore.
So you mentioned Maui and Big Island having some local impacts that were affecting those reefs. Are we seeing greater mortality in the corals there because they're combating the local impacts as well as some of these global warming impacts?
The global warming impacts up until last year had not really shown up in the surveys that we have done. We're still in the process of looking at last year's data for Maui. So we'll see if it is adding to the situation or not.
Okay, interesting. And I know you also have talked about doing some work with developing bioindicators for looking at the reefs. Now, for those of us that aren't in the marine science world, what exactly are bioindicators and what do you do with them?
Okay, we have worked with the Department of Health and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to develop these indicators that can look at decline of reefs. And since there are so many different interactions, we found that not one factor can really predict it, but a combination of factors have. Some of the factors we found are natural, like spatial complexity, which is the ups and downs of the bottom, waves, depth. And then there's human factors, like the population in an area, and silt and organics. And those can explain a lot of the variability in the fish and coral. So what we're doing is using these indicators of reef decline to develop models to connect the ridge and the reef using the Ahupua'a system and these indicators.
It's nice to see that it's a holistic or, you know, full-ranging view of the corals. Now, are you only using this in the field, out in the ocean, or are you looking at coral health in a lab setting as well?
Just like Chris's lab and Courtney's lab, we work in both the field and the lab. We have a number of projects we're working on to look at the synergistic effects of temperature and ocean acidification at the individual coral level and at the community level with our grad students. Some of them are conducting manipulative experiments to examine pigments in corals as they relate to bleaching, determining effects of sedimentation on coral fertilization, looking at isotopes that link the watershed with the reef. And we've recently been funded to model the link between the watersheds and the reefs and to determine the biological carrying capacity at Hanama Bay.
Interesting. And you mentioned Hanama Bay. In your personal opinion, when you're out there, do you see differences between Kaneohe Bay and Hanama Bay? Or are you seeing similar types of bleaching events?
Kaneohe Bay is really anomalous to the rest of the state. It's not like the reefs at Hanama Bay. Hanama Bay also is slightly anomalous to the rest of the state. But what we found at Hanama Bay, there was very little bleaching last year, and there is not much bleaching this year as compared to Kaneohe Bay. It's much more widespread in Kaneohe Bay.
Wow, and why do you think that is?
Hanama Bay has a lot more flushing that can bring these deeper waters in. Kaneohe Bay's residency time is much shorter, is much longer.
Interesting. And we talked a little bit about the different coral species and, you know, some variation even within the same species. In the work that you do, are you focusing on one particular coral or are you looking at many different kinds?
We're looking at several different kinds. We looked at 5 or 6 different species. And just like Chris said, some species are more susceptible to bleaching than others. Last year, though, an unusual thing happened where in Kaneohe Bay, we observed that the rice coral, and this year, the Montipora capitata, was more resistant to bleaching in comparison to the previously hardier finger coral. From our lab experiments, led by one of our graduate students, Keisha Barr, we're seeing the mushroom coral, Fungia, and the crust coral, Leptastria, can tolerate much higher temperatures. But again, as Chris mentioned, as temperatures continue to increase, we'll see how many of these can actually survive.
And this might be a really silly question, but this variety in the corals, you know, you said mushroom corals, they're kind of those round, low-to-the-ground corals. Does the height or branching affect how susceptible they are?
There's all kinds of things that affect the corals. Some of it might be the morphology or how branched and how encrusting they are. Some of these corals, like Leptastria and Fungia, are much smaller than the massive colonies that you're seeing. Fungia is a single coral. It's just one polyp compared with other colonial types of corals.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot of differences in spawning and other types of things.
Interesting. And the prognosis for the reefs, in your opinion, you know, we've talked a lot about how things are changing and the new normal, but what is your personal opinion on the prognosis of the reefs from this coral bleaching event?
Okay. The reefs will recover from the mortality this year. Last year in Kaneohe Bay, we saw 1% mortality. We also had a freshwater event along with the bleaching event, and we saw more mortality in some sections of the bay. But only 1% mortality could be attributed to the bleaching event. Courtney will be telling you about higher mortality that they saw in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. But I expect the prognosis for this bleaching event to be pretty good. I think they are already, like Chris said, starting to recover, and we have to remember, though, that there will be higher mortality year after year as bleaching continues.
So a mixed message of hope and caution there, again, seems to be the theme here. So, I mean, for those of us who aren't tied to the coral reefs for our careers, what can we do to help? How can we improve the situation?
That is a wonderful question. And I think right now we're at a pivotal place in history where the decisions we make in the next decade are going to determine the direction of our future. We've already lost nearly half of the world's reefs, but the good news is that half of the reefs are in good shape, including many of those here in Hawaii. We need sound management strategies based on scientific research, and that's going to play an increasingly more important role in the future of our reefs. It's going to take a global effort to minimize the effects of climate change, but we can all work together to make that difference. The problem originated on land, and the solution has to come from there, too. We have to reduce our carbon footprint. Now, we all know you reduce, reuse, recycle, but we can take this a step further. We can lessen our carbon impact when you think about the true cost of everything you buy. How much did it cost? Doesn't matter as much as where was it made? How far did it come to get here? What's the cost to the environment? How are you going to dispose of it? Is it recyclable? Buy local foods that aren't associated with the carbon travel costs. And eating lower on the food chain is important. It takes 10 times more energy each time you go up the chain. For instance, it takes 10 pounds of soybean or corn to make 1 pound of beef or pork and a lot of water. So eat more local fruits and vegetables and eat less meat and imported foods. And you can become part of the solution, too, by adopting new earth-friendly technology as they become available. With Hawaii's high energy costs, it's becoming economical now to use solar photovoltaic systems. Once we're more conscious of making decisions about living sustainably, we'll take that first step in securing our future. There's carbon footprint calculators online that can help people to determine where they can start cutting emissions. And Hawaii is at the forefront in setting laws that have taken a precedence and an example to the rest of the world. With 70% renewable and sustainable energy by 2030 in both electricity and transportation, we have ready access to renewable energy sources like solar, wind, wave, geothermal. It's an ideal location, and it can serve as a blueprint for the rest of the U.S. It will boost our local economy and lead to more stability and long-term reductions in energy costs and independence from imported fuels. And as you're doing, Carly, education of the public is vital. And it's an excellent time to educate the public as well as managers and legislators. And we still need to practice sustainable practices in our oceans to give the reefs their best possible chance.
Well, I think those are excellent messages of hope and very direct things that people can do. I hope everyone goes home tonight and calculates their carbon footprint, makes a little competition out of it, right? Give it a little bit of a challenge there. But thank you so much, Kule, that, you know, what you do and the information you're sharing is so important. So thank you so much for taking some time to be on the show.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more on coral bleaching and the northwestern Hawaiian Islands.
Do shopping online and using public Wi-Fi make you vulnerable to identity theft? Does giving out your social security number put you at risk? Is your dog at risk of identity theft? Yes, yes, and no. Your dog has absolutely nothing to worry about. But we do live in a world that can expose a lot of personal information, and that can lead to having your identity stolen and losing everything you've worked for. That's why at LifeLock, we use proprietary technology to detect a wide variety of threats. And unlike free credit monitoring services, we have a dedicated U.S.-based staff to help restore your identity if it ever is compromised. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But if you ask yourself whether you're worth protecting with the best, isn't the answer a resounding yes? Plans start at $9.99 a month, and now you can get 10% off. Go to lifelock.com and use promo code NEWS.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are talking about Hawaii's coral bleaching. With us now is Dr. Courtney Couch, a postdoctoral fellow at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology with Megan Donahue. Courtney completed her PhD in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Cornell University. Without further ado, welcome to the show, Courtney.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking a lot about coral bleaching here, some positive and some very scary messages here, but we've really focused on the main Hawaiian islands. Right here in our backyard, we have the Papahana Mokuakea Marine National Monument, or the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, one of the largest world's marine protected areas. Though I don't think we can protect them from the temperature changes that we're seeing. How are the reefs looking up there?
So last year, I went up with the Rapid Assessment and Monitoring Program in August to essentially help the monument expand their coral health and disease monitoring program. And at the time, the NOAA predictions were telling us that there was a bleaching watch into warning. And then by the end of the August cruise, we saw significant widespread bleaching, severe bleaching in a number of areas in the central to northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And so as a result, came back from that cruise and worked with the monument to become a part of their September cruise so that we could go back to permanent sites that were located in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands to track how this mass bleaching event affects the long-term survival and recovery of the reefs up there. So in a nutshell, what ended up happening was the bleaching event started up in August. It stuck around pretty much through September into the early part of October, and we saw pretty severe bleaching, especially around Lysianski Island, and so that was pretty striking. And when we went back, when I went back this year to follow up on how those reefs looked a year later, or just shy of a year later, the bleaching levels had significantly dropped, which was excellent. That drop is due largely to a reduction in the thermal stress. So basically, at the time that I surveyed again this year, the temperatures hadn't started to rise quite yet. And in terms of what the coral looked like, it varied. Like Chris and Kutule were saying, it really varied by region. Lysianski Island took a pretty significant hit. And what ended up happening was that along the eastern side of Lysianski Island, which was predominantly, last year was dominated by an endemic coral called Montipora dilatata. It's a purple rice coral that covered about 70% of the reefs for about a kilometer and a half of stretch of reef. Was all white last year, 90% of it was bleached, and then when we came back this year, the coral cover went from 70% to less than 1%, so most of it had died. I can't even explain what that looked like or felt like, but the good news is that as you move south into Lysianski, we still saw low levels of mortality, but there were signs of recovery of individual corals.
Well, that's good to hear. And so last year when you saw this bleaching, was this the first time there had been recorded bleaching or documented bleaching in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands?
No, this was actually the third reported event. So the first event was reported in 2002, and then there was a slightly milder event in 2004. The 2002 and 2004 events primarily affected Midway, Pearl and Hermes Atoll, and Kure Atoll, so the more northern atolls. And this year, what ended up happening was that the bleaching affected some of the northern islands, but also moved further south as well.
So it would be fair to say this has been the largest bleaching event that they've seen up there.
That's correct in terms of the severity and the extent of it.
And are there plans to continue to monitor throughout the rest of the year or into next year and see how the reefs fare with the continued temperature, heat temperatures? Or
I hope so. We spent a lot of time last year and this year setting up the framework that they could look at specific sites over time and kind of gauge what things will look like over time, not just now, but into the future. What I can tell you is that, so I went back in August of this year, which I mentioned was before they started seeing thermal stress in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. There was a September cruise that followed just after ours. And colleagues of mine told me that while they were not doing bleaching assessments, they were seeing bleaching in the lower portion, so French Frigate Shoals. The temperatures had started to increase. We definitely need to continue monitoring and hopefully, I know that bleaching assessments will be part of next year's plan. The Coral Reef Ecosystem Division that Kule was mentioning will be doing assessments, overall coral health assessments next year as part of their program.
Yeah. It will be definitely interesting to see how the reefs fare up there. And I know the NOAA Explorer, the Okeanos, was up there as well and doing some ROV work on deeper reefs. Are we seeing these bleaching events in mesophotic or deep reef areas, or is it just affecting our shallow corals?
So I can't tell you what it looked like this year, but what I can tell you is from last year, when I went back on the September cruise, which was a large portion of that cruise was devoted to mesophotic diving and mesophotic reefs, at Lisianski, where we saw the most severe thermal stress and bleaching, they were seeing bleaching down to 100, 150 feet, which is it's really hard to imagine that. And the even more striking was the temperature. We called it a thermocline, so the layer of warm water was incredibly deep. So normally the thermoclines, you get warm waters in the first, 30 feet or so, and then it starts to drop off and get cooler as you get deeper. They were seeing that drop off didn't happen until 150, 200 feet, which is pretty amazing.
That's shocking to me that this expansion is not only horizontal but vertical as well. I mean,
right. And
those depths, you would think that the water would be significantly cooler.
Right.
Wow, that is unbelievable. And so when you do these trips, I mean, it's so hard. You have such a limited time in these remote areas to go and monitor. How do you keep track of the reefs and where you're looking at from time to time? Do you go back to the same locations, or how do you organize that?
Right, so there's about a bazillion and one different ways you can monitor reefs. And we all have our very strong opinions on how we should do that. So there's sort of two schools of thought at the moment, and I actually employed both of them last year. So the first cruise, they use what's called a random stratified design. So that basically means that you go out onto the reef and you have a sort of a pre-randomly selected pool of sites at different types of habitats. So some on the back reef, the lagoon, some on the fore reefs. And that allows you to really get a good spatial assessment of what the reefs look like on, from fish to corals and all of that. And what we did the second cruise is because we wanted to look at what was happening at specific reefs over time, we went to permanent sites. So we went back to the exact same areas and surveyed the exact same section of reef in both years. And so through a combination of sort of the random method where you're getting a good spatial assessments and this sort of permanent design, you can get a combination of both spatial and temporal patterns.
Mm. And are you doing this work anywhere else? I know we're really focused on Hawaii, but we, as mentioned earlier, this is happening globally to reefs all over the world.
Right. So with regards to bleaching specifically, no. My work's really been focused in Papahanaumoku Marine National Monument. What I can say, though, is that earlier this year, as part of the Big Ocean Network, which we can talk about, I was working with partners in the UK to monitor reefs in the Indian Ocean, in the British Indian Ocean territory, which is literally in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And with that, we were doing overall coral health assessments and monitoring sites over time to look at how various factors are affecting changing coral health. And they, I actually, at that point, at the very end of our cruise, so our cruise was March into April, the very last week we started seeing bleaching, partial bleaching. And then the next week we had colleagues that were out there on a different expedition, and they started seeing the mass bleaching, which was reported to NOAA. And so we felt the effects.
And so what steps is NOAA or the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument taking to protect these reefs in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands?
Well, they're already doing pretty much as much marine protection as you could possibly possibly do. I mean, it is very, very limited access. There's virtually no human impacts up there except for several field camps and some permanent folks on Midway Island and Atoll. And even then, those impacts are highly regulated. There is no fishing. So they really do regulate who can go in there and what they can do. So short of that, I mean, what we're trying to do is use this event and highlight the fact, just as Kuhule and Chris were saying, that this is not just where humans are. This is everywhere. What is the true impact of global stressors in the absence of local stressors, and highlight do the absence of humans actually may not prevent these bleaching events from happening, but can they sort of promote the recovery from those events?
One of the things too that I think is really commendable about NOAA and the Monument Office is that the scientists that are working in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands are really talking to the management, talking to the managers and policymakers, and sharing that information, which you don't always see elsewhere. How's that experience been for you?
This event has been unprecedented for a lot of different reasons, good reasons and bad reasons. And one of the things that we did as a collective across academic and nonprofit and the governmental sectors is we saw this coming, right? This year we were looking at the predictions and all going, oh gosh, what's happening? And then we all sat down at a table and we started talking about who's doing what and where and what can we do? How can we use the science that we're gathering to help better manage the reefs? And so that all starts with having those discussions and making sure we all know who's doing what and who can do something.
Well, I think that's the key take home here is all of you do such amazing work and have talked so eloquently about the research that you're doing and provide a little glimmer of hope with a realistic expectation of these reefs and what we're doing. Courtney, where can we find out more information if we want to learn more and also learn how we can maybe change our ways a bit?
Right. There's a lot of fantastic resources out there. Here locally, the Division of Aquatic Resources has a website that is devoted, as part of their rapid response plan, is devoted to providing information on what bleaching is and what is sort of the latest status of thermal stress and bleaching. I can provide that website to you. Also, the NOAA has a fantastic resource as well. It's the basics of bleaching biology. What does that actually look like?
Well, we'll be sure to get those resources and sites up on the All Things Marine radio show website. I want to take a second here to give a warm mahalo to our guests today, Courtney Kuhle and Chris, for joining us and talking about this really important subject. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.